Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the second installment of Library Love. We are with Natalie Draper, the director of Library Services in Northfield. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Rich. How's it going?
Good. You must have enjoyed the first one because you came back to do another.
Well, and same. I mean, you said, okay, let's do this again.
I love it. I think it's great.
There's so much more to talk about.
So, well, very clearly, there's so much more to talk about because there's been a development in the world of library movers and shakers.
Things
right?
have happened.
Mm-hmm. And we are also have here Angelica Linder. Good morning, Angelica. How
Good
are you?
Morning. Good. Thank you.
I'm fantastic.
Yes.
Thank you. And, you, Angelica, and you, Natalie, mm-hmm. have been recognized by the Library Journal. Do I have that right?
Library Journal, yeah.
The mm-hmm. Library Journal mm-hmm. as movers and shakers in the world of library.
The library
shakers.
That's amazing. And as I understand this, Library Journal looks at. They talk to libraries across country,
mm-hmm.
All of them, which there are quite a few. Off the top of your head, do you have any idea how many libraries there are in America?
All I know is that there are more than McDonald's.
Okay.
That stat is still true.
Yeah.
It's been true for a long time, and it continues to be true.
That is good. That is a good stat.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it makes me incredibly happy, that stat. They select 50 people mm-hmm. to who they believe are movers and shakers, and they put those people in different categories.
Mm-hmm.
And Angelica, you were selected as
a community builder.
Mm-hmm. And Natalie, you're an agent of change.
Yep. I'm a whole change agent. It felt about right. I like to move the furniture. I think I made that joke last Friday, but it didn't work because we couldn't announce this yet.
But you could do it again.
Yes.
People can repeat jokes.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask each of you to talk about the other. All right.
Okay.
All right. I love that.
So Natalie, Angelica was selected as a community builder. What does that mean, and why are they right?
To me, it is what I wrote. So these are based on nominations.
Uh-huh.
I'll say that. So what I wrote about Angelica was that her first thought is always, how can the library help? And that she brings that with her to work every day in everything that she does.
That's
how can
great.
The library serve the community? And so I feel like community builder really summed up what she does with
mm-hmm.
working with partners and really strengthening the partnerships that the
mm-hmm.
library has. I think always looking to do a bit more for the community. And also, how can we be supporting the community partners who we do count on, who do so much to serve the community too?
Mm-hmm.
So
what are the, first of all, Angelica, your job is your community outreach, correct?
Yes, outreach manager.
Outreach mm-hmm. manager. What has Angelica done within that job?
I mean, we can go back a ways before she was in the management position. You remind me what year it was that Hispanic Heritage was first conceived of in your brain.
2018.
It was 2018.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So in 2018, she had a little idea for something that over the years has turned into, I think, one of Northfield's proudest achievements.
The Hispanic Heritage
Celebration.
Celebration.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I didn't realize that was you.
That was my baby.
That's
my baby. Well, now just mine, the community baby.
Well, sure,
I would
of course,
say.
But
and that's part of that testament to her work, right?
Is
that it is always a team effort, but she's really good at getting people together to go along on a good idea.
And it has become a staple in Northfield. Yes. Like people mm-hmm. talk about, defeat of Jesse James mm-hmm. Days, and they talk about Pride Weekend. They talk about Hispanic Heritage Day, which kicks off Hispanic Heritage Month.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And now, I mean, those good ideas have a way of leading to other good ideas,
yes.
of course.
Mm-hmm. Right? And you start planting these seeds as a community builder does.
Yes.
And so at St. Olaf last year, or the year before, I guess, end of the year before last, inspired by what we'd done with Hispanic Heritage, reached out to the library about supporting a community-wide celebration of Asian American, Pacific Islander, mm-hmm. Native American, or Native Hawaiian Heritage Month.
Yes.
So, and that was celebrated, our second year of that was celebrated this past
last
weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, last Saturday.
We had more than 500 people out there in the street.
That's awesome.
For Celebrate Asia Pacifica. It was a fantastic event. Student organizations were performing in the city's fancy stage.
The taiko drums, man.
I love the taiko drums.
So cool.
So one thing they want to add to that is like, just think about a few years back, also Emily Lloyd got the idea of Pride. Mm-hmm. So Pride at the Park. So it's like what she's saying about the planting the seed. It's like sometimes you see the possibilities when someone else is doing something. Say, oh, yes, mm-hmm. I'm going to be able to do something like that,
yeah.
or making their own. So it's like different initiatives that are come up with seeing how can we do something different at the library.
Pretty cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. You were also pretty instrumental in the municipal ID program, weren't you?
I don't want to take too much credit out of that. I will say that when I was hired as an outreach coordinator, my job was being the Spanish interpreter. Implementing the CDID at the library, you know, making people feel comfortable coming and get their ID there as a safe space. Mm-hmm. And we continue to be a safe space for the whole community. And then part of the outreach that I did with the CDID was going with the chief police and other officials to talk to the community and share about the information with the CDID.
Okay.
What was doing. We did also a campaign. Well, I don't know if campaigns, but visits to the colleges as well.
Mm-hmm.
And pass and share the word about the CDID and to this day, we still issue the cards at the library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, and training new staff to be able to continue doing that.
All right, and we are still, I think, one of the few cities in the state of Minnesota that issues a city ID. Yep. Right?
Yes. We were the first one.
The first
yeah.
one of the
yeah.
few.
Well,
isn't that like interesting? Northfield likes to be the first one on everything,
right?
We're like the good kids, like kind of thing.
We like to push the envelope around.
Yes, yeah. exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely.
yeah. So.
What else? What else should we know about Angelica, Natalie?
Andale. How deep are you trying to get this?
In a profession with a lot of introverts, myself included, it is really powerful to have some extroverts on staff.
Is Angelica the reason the library became a non-shush building?
I don't know.
I mean, I've always said this, like the person in a library most likely to be shushed is a librarian.
Right.
But I think that another thing that Angelica brings to her work is a lot of joy.
Yes,
thank you.
And really makes people feel like they belong, from our student workers to our staff. She's a mentor for all of us. So I'm grateful for the joy that she brings to work.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Well, Angelica, your friend Natalie over here was nominated as an agent of change.
I was surprised when she said she was going to nominate me. I'm like, what? Oh, okay. I surprise people to, like, people don't know that I don't like to bring attention, even though I'm like, you know,
you're out there
ready to like I'm not afraid to talk to people, right. even if whoever it is.
Yeah.
And bringing joy, I will agree with that. But bringing attention to the like awards and things like that, I'm not too much into looking for those recognitions.
Yeah,
you know,
I get that.
I would rather to build relationship with different community members, with my peers, and continue growing those relationships and learning from both ways, you know.
Okay.
But one of the things that when Natalie mentioned that she was nominated, I was surprised. I was, what did I say, proud and happy. I was like, oh, my job is being recognized, which is, it's always nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got the award, the email, I was like, oh my. Okay. Maybe there is something there, right?
Right.
So my good friend Laura and other friends are like, you got to take ownership of that. Like, it's yeah, it's the word that you put it in and they change and just let's celebrate. So now it's kind of like sinking in about the magnitude of that award.
One of 10 people from across the country to be honest.
You're gonna get me more nervous. People would not believe I didn't share the news besides with my husband and I think David, my student worker, because he was in my office when I got the news. Not even with my mom. And then on the trip, my coworker Alexa, who was in a trip in Colombia with us, with Laura and Derek, she was the one who broke the news to my mother. I'm like, I haven't shared anything with anyone. Now it's sinking. Now it's like, okay,
good.
This is a big deal. It's an honor. I don't want to take away that. But I also always telling everyone, it's a work that we doing together. Because... Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm so proud of having the library director that we have, because it doesn't matter if you bring some ideas or trying to make some changes. If the leaders in that organization are the ones who are not supporting you or, you know, or working with you alone to make those changes, it's going to be harder to do those shifts. So when she was nominated by Emily Lloyd and she got the award, I like, oh, this is so cool. And then two people awarded and the library is amazing. So.
Two of the 50 movers and shakers in the country, right here.
Two
in
one small library is pretty remarkable, actually.
It's awesome.
I did not know that I was nominated until... Like, basically.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Emily got sneaky on you.
I kept that a secret. So
I was like, right. That's great. So, Angelica, why do you think Natalie was honored as an agent of change?
One of the things that I just mentioned is since she's been taken on as a library director, it's supporting the whole staff and to do those changes, really listening to the staff and the community, what it doesn't need to be done. Mm. Besides the work that she does with the library, she also with the Art and Culture Commission, and you can see the reflection of trying to have diversity and representation and the art around the city, which is overdue. I mean, like, how long do we can have a nice art done by Rocky Casilla, for example, at the library? So so mine, I will say, she said, like, bring energy and joy. She being visuals to the library and the city. And her initiative or seeing something and transform a space. And then everyone... go on board to do those changes. An example of why I was excited for her to get nominated, besides the work with the Art and Culture Commission, was one of the initiatives was the Oasis, right? Mm-hmm. That hallway empty space, mm-hmm. which was nothing. If you see the pictures, were like, and now is something transformed and unusual, a very used space.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then connect everyone who is around that area.
It really is. the Oasis is a really remarkable thing. Just for you to have seen that space as something that could be different, because I think I've been there, right? I got a great tour from you. I think anyone would just sort of walking through that building wouldn't give that space... Mm-hmm. a second look. It's just a connection between two parts of the building.
It's a wide hallway.
Right, right. That's what it is. And you saw something that is now, like you say, Angelica, really remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, it's beautiful. Besides that, say the static, but beyond that, is the usage of that space, mm-hmm. right? With all of the different nonprofit organizations in that building. Plus being close to the high school, the middle school. Yeah. And then there's some also low-income families or households close to that space where they can just use the computer, print their own things, use the fax, and also check out materials. So And we have a beautiful patio. So we have also incremented certain programs at the space as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's a spark of something new and useful.
Right,
and,
right.
Yeah.
How is she as a boss?
Oh, no. Should I leave?
Yeah, I would say, oh, no. Let's keep it friend. No, I'm kidding.
Be perfectly
I think she is patient.
Okay.
Right. I think she got patient because, sometimes I can be a little bold. So she knows I, Caitlin here, who's going to be talking a little bit shortly, she knows. Sometimes I don't have a filter and it's like I don't mean it. But is the type of person that I like things clear. We have an issue. Let's talk about it.
Yep.
You didn't like what I said. Okay, well, what can we resolve? So through communication, I think, we can move forward. So she's a great library director. I will say that I have learned tons from her. I see her as a mentor. And working at the library, I feel like I have like 3 or 4 mentors, even people that they don't know already learn from them. Like Caitlin, she's very quiet right here sitting. But when you were talking about that word, it's like, yeah, probably it's one person a word, but it's the work, the teamwork that we
absolutely.
Do. You know, the reflection of the collection development, right? The Spanish collection, which Caitlin managed. Reflecting those new books there for my Spanish book club. I couldn't have do all that without the support of all of them. Mm-hmm. So
it's pretty cool.
You know,
That's what I had said when Library Journal interviewed us for the write-up was like, I was like, it's actually hard for me to talk about any of these things that you're asking me about without talking about all of the people who actually make all of this work.
Sure.
Because it's one thing to walk into a hallway and I'm like, oh, I can see a library here, but it's another thing to just try to do that on your own, right? There are a lot of people and our entire team really does work as a team.
One of the things you're honored for in the article is the people you hire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your staff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a skill to that, I'll say.
tell me about it, man.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your staff and how, but beyond what you've just said.
I would say that my approach is, one, my approach to management is playing to people's strengths, but also giving people the opportunity to stretch out and try new things, to explore, to be able to work together. And what I look for when we're recruiting people is, one, I want our staff to really reflect the community that we serve. People trust your library more if they see people like them working there. If you see yourself reflected in the programs, if you see yourself reflected in the staff, you're going to see yourself in the programs and in the collection and in the signage that we have around the building.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see more bald guys on your staff.
You know what, Rich? I will take that to heart. Think
but uni, did you remember uni? I think she's bold. Our unicorn. I brought it here to the radio, remember?
Oh, Sparkles?
Sparkles, yeah, yes. She's
not bald. She's got a beautiful mane.
She's a purple. Well, sort of like
that's
mohawk.
Right.
So
okay,
that's
well, nice. Almost.
We'll work on that.
Okay, anyway.
Well, what I mean is too, and something that we've been talking about too, is sort of homegrown librarians and how are we working with the community to make sure that people see themselves not only on our staff, but that they can have a career there. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that I've really worked on is having more full-time opportunities at different levels in the staff too, so that, you know, I think we have leaders at every level, in every position we have leaders, and I learn something from every single person on my team. And so to have an opportunity where you could see like, this isn't just a job to me. This can be like my career. Like I can feel supported here. We support professional development opportunities. We take people to conferences. We support their tuition. The city has a generous tuition reimbursement policy that we make available to anybody on the staff. So we want people to see like, not necessarily pursuit of the master's in library science, because it's not for everybody. And I get that. But I want there to be leadership opportunities for people in the library that are also well compensated, that are not necessarily a master's required position. So that's one thing that we've worked on, is creating more full-time opportunities at different levels, and also more leadership positions that aren't necessarily dependent on the on the master's degree. And Angelica is actually one of those. Well, I would, mm-hmm. I'd love to encourage her to get her master's when the time comes that she is in a management position at
Can you believe it?
And
thinking to become a real librarian.
You're already a real librarian.
You are a real librarian. With the title, yes. I'm not surprised that you would be going. And not at all. I want to ask you one more question, and this is the, with just a couple of minutes left, I'm going to ask the broadest question I can possibly think of. All right, you're an agent of change, right? What does that mean? How does being an agent of change in a library, what does that mean for the community?
I think to the community, it means that their library will always adapt around what the community needs. That we're always open to possibility and seeing potential everywhere. I think for us to really be change agents is also seeing the potential in our partners, partner organizations, people just in the community, and what's possible here. It's just being open to what's possible, I think. I think it's like, I guess people need to see it as change because it feels like you're always doing something different. To me, I feel like it's just an extension of the mission. Mm-hmm. And what we've always done. And I would go back to Ranganathan's 5 laws of library science. You'd like to talk about that. But one, the last one, and my favorite, is the library's a growing organism. Mm-hmm. And that one sort of like redefines the 4 that come mm-hmm. before it too, right? And even just the way that we describe it, like the way that the laws were originally written, they refer to books because that is the most obvious connection to libraries. And the main thing that we did for a long time, and in Ranganathan's time, that was true. Now it's sort of more resources, things, ideas, mm-hmm. even like that we provide access to the world of ideas. So I don't know that change actually, even though I like to think of that because I'm very comfortable moving the furniture.
Yeah.
Right. And I think sort of in a way, like an artist might look at a lump of clay and see something beautiful and see artwork. Right. I look at an empty hallway with some boxes stacked in the corner and I see a library. So that is just, I think, just seeing potential.
That's fantastic.
And I will say, I will add that also she has an eye for grants. She will come, we had the opportunity to do a summer internship mm-hmm. pay. I think it's something that was in the nomination for the mm-hmm. For the award. And it was thanks to a grant last year. So we were able to have 4 summer interns. Those were from the Northfield Community Collaborative College and the Torch Program. So it's to see themselves work in the library. You really don't need a library title, I would say. Yeah. To be able to see yourself working mm-hmm. at the library. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that we changed. That's why I was saying that she sees the opportunity. How can we reflect and support our community in different ways of like growing professionally and keep things here in a way? You know what I mean? How many local, most of our staff is from the library, and continue supporting mm-hmm. the people that are here, going to the community college, going to the high school, and keep them here in town.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. Well, I will tell you, all 3 of you, at the Northfield Public Library is one of the gems of this community. It's really something that I personally am incredibly proud of to have in this community, and I am not alone.
Thank you.
I think we all really treasure the fact that this library is here, and what the 3 of you and all of your colleagues mm-hmm. have built is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And so thank you. And congratulations on well-earned honors.
Thank you. Yes, thanks.
All right. So we will be, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more Library Love. Don't go away.
Library Love.
Welcome back to Library Love. Natalie, you've got yet another of your amazing, member of your amazing staff. You've got Caitlin here to mm-hmm. talk about some curation and development type of things.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think that one of my goals for this podcast was diving into some topics that I think are kind of mysterious to people, right? So maybe demystifying some of the behind the scenes work. And people often relate to the staff that they see out front a lot. And Caitlin is out front a lot too, but a lot of her work is like very behind the scenes, but it's really, really important to what we do with the library, right? She does collection development, mm-hmm. and is mostly responsible for the adult collections in the library. And I rely on her expertise in building the collection budget and making sure that we have the right amount of space in the building allocated to the collections that we have, right? She works with Amy Nelson, our e-services manager, too, on that. And Tyler also does a lot of collecting for the library. But so what I wanted to bring Caitlin in to talk about is the part that I think some people think that we don't do at all, which is removing books from the library when we have not enough room. Because when you think about something like, well, and I want to turn this over to Caitlin. First, what is weeding?
Yeah, great question. So first, hello, I'm Caitlin. I'm glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me. This is fun for me to be able to talk a little bit more about some of that behind the scenes stuff. So question is, what is weeding? And what do we mean when we say we remove books from the library? Maybe what does that look like? So weeding is a big, we call it weeding. It's and that's sort of the whole process of taking things out of the library collection. Now, I'm always putting things into the library collection. And weeding is something that you can think of it as a metaphor, you know, a gardening metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. So just like in your yard at home, from time to time, you're going to have to pull some weeds. You're going to have to pull things out plant-wise that you don't want or that have gotten overgrown. Your yard's overcrowded. Pull out these weeds to make room for the plants you do want. It's the same thing at the library. Space at the library is finite. Our building's mm-hmm. not getting any bigger, and yet books are published every day. So we're constantly adding new material, and then that means that something has to go. So those two things, the buying of new books that I do, and then the weeding really go hand in hand and have to happen at almost the same rate. Otherwise, our shelves are full and overcrowded.
Right.
So that's what weeding is taking things off the shelf.
So it's not exactly one in, one out, but we actually, it's fairly close with us. We're pretty good. We have to be, one, we're a very high circulating library, which just really speaks to the amount of love and also probably the amount of reading that mm-hmm. Northfielders do, which is probably mm-hmm. unsurprising.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right? It's about 400 items a month that we're adding to the collection, kind of on average.
A month?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And that's physical items.
Yeah.
Right. That doesn't include all of our electronic resources. And I think we've talked about before, that's even where our greater circulation is happening now, is even on our electronic items. So, yeah. So it's a lot of things that are going in and out. But thankfully, there's some criteria that we use to help make those decisions.
Yeah.
I don't know if we want to get into
that. Yes, let's go ahead and get into some of the how do you make a decision about what stays and what goes.
Right. There's a couple different resources we use. And I guess before I even get into that, I want to back up and just for people who sort of like have a knee-jerk reaction or like clutch their pearls a little bit thinking about like taking books off the shelf. Something that I, you know, like to think of as I'm doing this is that this is really library best practice. All libraries do this. And moreover, it's kind of like research shows that when you remove books from the library, when you have a well-weeded collection and your shelves are 2/3 to 3/4 full, there's some open space, it looks friendly and welcoming and inviting, it's not like grandma's overstuffed attic in there.
Right.
If it looks clean and neat and it's easy to find a book on the shelf, circulation checkouts actually goes up. So people are more likely to use your library, more likely to find your library appealing and easy to use if you have a neat space. So that's part of it too. Is like more books are actually getting into people's hands, more reading can actually happen if we're letting the new, good, up-to-date information really shine on the shelf by getting rid of stuff that's obsolete.
Baked into that is a little bit of a contradiction I think that people wouldn't quite think of, is the more space we can create on the shelves, the more our circulation goes up, the more we can actually have in the collection. Mm-hmm. Because if our stuff is being stored in people's houses, we can have more that's available for people to borrow locally.
We don't have to store it.
Right.
Right. If it's checked out.
Terms. Yeah.
So that's like it's invisible. Super kind of secret thing. Like we know we have that and we know that it can come back. Some material, especially when it's new, and you can talk about this a little bit too, the kind of turnover rate, but some, like when a book is new, it doesn't really get put back on the shelf for a while. Like think of what's a bestseller you can use as an example, maybe.
The horrible / wonderful example of The Women by Kristen Hannah. We have maybe like 20 copies of this book, which is an astronomical number for this community, to have 20 copies of a book. But it was so popular for so long, none of those copies were on the shelf. There was a hold list. You know, people are waiting for this book. And so we can buy, you know, 5 copies of a book or whatever, and they're out, they're checked out, they're not on the shelf, so it doesn't take up any room. When that demand wanes for the book and those, you know, then there's multiple copies sitting there, that's when we would weed the extra copies.
Sure.
Then we only need one copy, you know, and that will suffice for the remainder of the time that that book is popular and is in use. So that's kind of baked in to the process too.
What do you do with the books once they've been weeded? You don't like have the big bonfire or anything, do you? No.
Definitely not. Everybody, I just want to assure our listeners that absolutely no bonfires. But that is a really good question because we have a few different ways that we rehome books once they've been pulled from the collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one is the book sale shelves that you'll see when you go into the library. That's kind of the first step is those books go on sale for community members to buy. They bring them home, then you have it at your house, you know. So that's a great option for us. We also work with a company called Better World Books. So we can box up the books and they're picked up. And then it goes to, it's basically a reseller.
Yeah, they recycle them, and I'm putting air quotes around that, but I'm not sure, like, if all of them, because they have a criteria for what we can give them, they won't take certain things. So something is just falling apart, we're not going to put that on the sales shelf. Right. We can't send that to Better World Books. If it has been, a dog has gone to town on that book, it's going in. I'm afraid I'm going to tell you that we do occasionally put books in the trash.
Well, okay.
And that is when they have just lived their life.
No.
They have done their service, then they go.
Yeah, and that kind of brings me back to what is the criteria? When does the book kind of get to that end of lifespan? Yeah. And I'm happy to talk about that. It's so librarians use a handbook of guidelines, or there's a couple different manuals that are out there that give criteria that help us know when something might have lived its useful life. So one of those is called the Crew Manual. It's a handbook that's put out by Texas State Library and Archives Commission, or has been for a long time. And it's kind of like a rubric that a teacher would use in a classroom to kind of grade, right? And give you some objectivity as you're looking at this book to decide if I'm going to keep this or get rid of this. Okay. And so, especially in like nonfiction, information ages at different times. So legal and medical information doesn't have a real long life. That stuff changes all the time, and it's important to have up-to-date information. So,
that makes perfect sense.
So those books, honestly, I think it's 5 years. You know, it's not a real long time that we would keep stuff. And sure, it can be shorter if there's developments that we're aware of, and we can say, we know this book is no longer up-to-date because it contains this information. So it kind of gives a timeline for different categories of information. Travel books are another one that have a pretty short shelf life. Mm-hmm. You don't want to buy a travel guide that's over 2 years old because a lot of the hotels, restaurants, and other reviews that are in there are no longer going to be relevant.
Well, think about what happened with the pandemic.
And
oh, my gosh.
How many places went
closed? You just kind of had to start over with your travel guides.
Basically.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the kind of criteria that's in there. The other side of it is... there's an acronym, MUSTY, which kind of says it all. But
I like musty books, though. I mean,
I like that. Don't be too musty.
I kind of like that smell.
There's a smell, but then there's another smell.
I like a musty old bookstore. Right. Is what I like. Anyway,
sure. But I don't know. You don't want too much of that.
We're going to do another show actually in the future on just the chemical explanation of what the smell is that's positive. There is actually like a there's a chemistry reason for it.
I can't wait to talk about that. Okay.
Anyway. I might bring a chemist on to talk about it, actually.
Caitlin, we're stealing your thunder.
Totally fine. I'm fascinated too. Basically, you don't want things on your shelf that are ugly, things that are outdated. You know, I think the acronym here, it's like misleading, factually inaccurate. U, ugly. S, superseded. So that would be like there's a new edition.
Sure.
T, trivial. This is pop culture from 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Right.
Nobody cares about that celebrity's particular scandal now. I, irrelevant. So that's kind of similar, but maybe like there's not community interest here in that topic. E would be elsewhere available. So that's something that this is readily available through interlibrary loan. We don't need to have a copy here.
Something that might be duplicated with our college libraries, right? Mm-hmm. We don't buy a lot of academic resources because we know that that's well served and they have generous local lending policies.
Yeah. So what it all kind of comes down to is like that is maybe the physical packaging of the material as well as some characteristics about the content. That would mean that that book is no longer something that we need to have in our collection. Somebody's dog chewed it, you know, it's mildewed, whatever. Right. That definitely counts as ugly.
Do you keep, I assume you keep track of how often a book is checked out. And if something's been sitting on the shelf for what, a year or something, that then
that's the other side, is that there's also dead items. Yeah. So we also run reports that tell us, you know, all that checkout data. So we can, we have these sort of objective rubrics, I guess, these guidelines. And then next to that, we have our more quantitative data. So we can look at it and say, this book hasn't checked out for 2 years. It's been sitting on the shelf. You know, at that point, we're dusting it.
Yep.
So we don't need to have this thing.
And that number changes depending on which collection and how much space we have for it, the volume that's moving. So like,
it might be two, it might be 3 years.
Just for adult collections, like fiction's going to be a much shorter number than, say, our nonfiction.
Yep. I would say especially in combination, if a nonfiction book has not checked out in 2 or 3 years and there's any of these other issues with it, then we really don't want to be giving shelf space to that book.
I don't want to get too deep into this if it's a whole nother like conversation, but is deciding what to bring in, is that a really broad topic, or can I ask you right now, how do you decide what you're bringing on, bringing in?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, what to bring in can be pretty broad, and it can be a little bit less scientific. It's maybe more of a guessing game. Probably easier to decide what to weed than what to bring in. So selecting, like choosing the books that I buy, it a lot of times comes down to reviews that are in professional journals, you know, reviews that are out there of the book, as well as bestsellers, obviously, we're going to buy. So there's some early indicators like that. So we use a lot of the same information that like bookstores use to choose what we're going to buy.
That makes sense.
But then sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. You know, you buy a book and maybe nobody wants it. So,
or maybe there's like a sleeper hit. You didn't know this thing was going to be a really big, that was going to win a Booker Prize or something like that. And then you end up going back and, you know, buying multiple copies of an older book.
I feel like I have completely usurped your interview, Natalie. So
no, that's completely fine, because I think of Rich, your role here is kind of the person who's outside the library.
Right? I don't know what the heck we're talking about, so I've got all kinds
of
questions.
Library land, and that's what I want for listeners to get a little bit of like, okay, here's our world, but here's how other people can understand what the heck we're talking about.
You know, I think maybe one misconception about the process of choosing what do we have at the library and what are we going to take out of the library is that people a lot of times think that, well, isn't that censorship?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think like how do you distinguish that that decision making process from this is a book that I don't like, you know?
Right.
And you can take my word for it, and I can tell you like here's what I'm looking at when I'm making those decisions. But I think there is some anxiety about that too, especially today.
I would like to talk to the person that wants to accuse the Northfield Public Library of censorship. I'm interested in that particular point of view, because that's a curious one for me.
One thing I have heard over the years, not just here, but you always hear this as a librarian, that people have a perception that libraries have like purged or removed classics. And again, I'm going to put kind of air quotes around that. That we don't have an abundance of what they expect to see on the shelves in a library. And some of that is going back to what we've already talked about, that we don't actually have the luxury of space to be able to just house books for eternity, because one person's classic is another person's trash. I'm just going to say, right? Yeah, that is not.
Absolutely.
And vice versa, right? So that for us to adhere to one fairly narrow, say, like, Western impression of what, like, a canon of literature that a library must certainly have on their shelves is, doesn't necessarily meet the needs of your community. And here, being that we are small, and we are definitely limited to space, we have a collection that responds to the tastes of our community that is mostly like local, relevant, popular interest, because we also have the benefit of being able to bring in materials from all over, right? We have this great Selco partnership. Mm-hmm. We have statewide interlibrary loan, which hopefully gets to continue. We can also pull in books from outside the region if we can't find it through MinLink. And Caitlin is one of the people who will do that, track down books outside of the library. But that that's usually, it's not so much that, like, that sometimes that's the accusation, I guess, of censorship that you'll get from folks, is that they see, like, because I don't have, like, readily available on the shelf, maybe it's checked out, but we don't have it on the shelf. We don't have a copy of, I don't know, just throughout Jane Eyre. Maybe. I'm sure we do, actually.
We definitely have
a copy of Jane Eyre. Because it gets checked out, though, right? Some things are a classic for a reason, because they actually are still, they're still on lots of reading lists. They're still popular. Book clubs still read them. They're still really good books. They're still relevant.
But do we have every book by F. Scott Fitzgerald? Absolutely not.
Though he's a Minnesotan.
Do you have a copy of Wuthering Heights?
I'm certain we do.
Okay. I've been listening to that song a lot lately. I'm thinking I need to go read the book now.
I love that song.
I never read the book. So anyway.
Great book. Great movie.
Yeah. Great song.
And I'm so, but again, like, Jane Eyre is a terrible example because I pulled it out because it's just like an obvious book. That, of course, we have a copy of that. But there are certain things that people will have an expectation that they're going to see. And there is absolutely no chance that if that book needs to be in a library somewhere, it is, and I can get it for you in days.
Well, and the other piece of that, too, is that if we have, you know, the backlist of every author that you can classify as classic, you know, it's on somebody's English high school reading list. If we have that, then we're not making space for representation of, you know, diverse voices. We're not having new authors that we, you know, people of color. We're not having characters and authors that reflect all of our community.
We have to be open to adding books to the canon. We can't just close that door.
Now, okay, if it's, I'm assuming there's a copy of The Odyssey. In the library.
Right? Okay.
Now there's a movie,
multiple versions of it,
coming out, like with a huge cast.
Yeah.
Right? This is going to be a really popular movie. I happen to love The Odyssey. I think it's one of the greatest stories I've ever read in my life, and I think that movie is going to spark a lot of interest in the book. Mm-hmm. Do you guys anticipate that, and maybe bring in two or three more copies or something like that?
Well, and there's like a million different adaptations and you know, editions of the Odyssey, right?
Yeah.
That's
right, but often timed to a movie release or something. There will be a new edition of the book that comes out,
That's true.
A new translation or a new adaptation, you know. So yes, definitely that. Ideally, yes, we're anticipating those trends and getting those things on the shelf so they're ready when things happen and there's a resurgence of interest. The other thing is, when you have an old classic on the shelf, it's worn out, maybe it's time to replace with something that's up to date and fresher. You know, you can get a new paperback copy for pretty cheap, and it's going to look a lot better of the same work.
You know, it's kind of a good example of something that drove demand that we couldn't necessarily, well, we did meet it, I think, but like Bridgerton was something that where the adaptation was more popular than the book ever was.
Yeah.
So it kind of revived it, but I think it wasn't out of print, but I
but they re-release new copies with like the actors on the cover, right? And so all that. So then get that copy, because that's going to be more interesting to people. They know right away, oh yeah, that goes with the show that I'm watching.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of us did not have that around when that like was coming out either.
I stopped watching Bridgerton after the first season. Is it worth the watch?
Did you guys keep up with it?
I'm a romance person, so yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely.
All right.
I am definitely not a romance person, but if you want to talk about Stranger Things.
I'm two seasons behind on that, too. I know.
Well, they may never come out with an. I know, I've been waiting for this movie for years. So.
David Harbour keeps making other weird movies. Know, right? So, okay, we're going to take another break and come back and talk about the very unpleasant topic of censorship. We'll be back.
Library Love.
Welcome back to Library Love with Natalie Draper, and our friend Caitlin is sticking around here. So, you know, there's this disturbing trend lately where people are telling people who think their moral compass is better than mine. Are telling us what we can read and what we can't read. What's happening in that world these days, Natalie?
So, funny you ask. I've got the State of America's Libraries report sitting right here, one of my visual aids for today's program. But one thing that this report, so backing up a little bit, over the last few years, basically since like 2019, we've had steadily increasing years of ban and challenge books. Like each year basically doubles the year before, right? Like the numbers just keep going up and up. So what this year's report found was that most of the challenges that are happening now are being driven by either pressure groups.
Mm-hmm.
So organizations like Moms for Liberty, I'll use them as an example because they actually had like an official Booklicks website that some libraries, including libraries in Minnesota, are using to pull books from their collections. And then government or elected officials, government and boards and administration.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them are not being driven by individual challenges, by parents, by students themselves, by librarians.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. It's a very coordinated effort that's coming out. And I think that was probably the more, at some point you start talking about like these ban and challenge book lists and the list of the top 10 for last year is like, oh yeah, okay, that one's been on the list a few times. That one's been on the list a few times. Of course, that one's been on the list. Some are kind of surprising, but the list itself becomes less surprising because these groups are operating from like a manual at this point, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes a much larger movement. And of course, what we'll get to is how big it's going to be in 2025, which a lot of this is now being driven directly by the federal government. But so yes, that's kind of where we are with the state of libraries is we know with the data, what it shows us is that it is these very coordinated efforts to remove big swaths of books.
Yes.
Right. Long lists, like 100, they'll come to library board meetings with like 100 titles on a list and try to get these taken out. And they are ideological. Books on race and gender predominantly. Or what? So last year's, should we go through the top 10
from
last year?
Yeah, absolutely.
Number one.
But well, Natalie, if you don't mind. So what really was striking about this report this year is that finding that it was pressure groups. And I think we've heard about the number of challenges going up and up and up. But that, and I don't know what the percentage was, but super high percentage.
Of pressure groups.
Of these challenges it was more than are a coming
quarter,
from organized groups.
Just pressure groups. And then
so that's
boards
the real
and
news
government
there,
were like,
right?
Yeah, we're close to 50%.
Wow.
That's crazy to me.
Right. So it's very, I will say it's very organized. It's very coordinated.
And it allows for people to sort of hide behind a label too.
Well, that too.
You know, they don't have to put their own name on it. They don't have to show their face on it. Right. They can just,
But it also shows like how powerful that kind of coordinated intimidation can be. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yes.
if you're there with your, me and my library board, and I've got, a very coordinated effort. A lot of people coming from outside of town, coming to,
rabble rousers,
remove some books from the library.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's people saying that I know better than you do about what you should even have access to. This isn't like, we don't have a captive audience.
Right.
Right. Like it was completely optional to come to the library and to check out a book. It's all your choice entirely.
Yes.
So if you don't like something, which there's a good chance you'll pick up a book you don't like, and it's something that you don't agree with, we're happy to find you something that you do like, that does meet your values, that does meet the values of your family, that feels like a better fit for you, but for you to say, well, I don't like that book, so I don't think anybody else should be able to read it either.
Right.
That's a different story.
Right.
And that's what we actually don't allow in the state of Minnesota, which is nice that we don't remove books for ideological reasons.
Which is
except
nice.
When we do.
I'm glad to hear that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm interested in the top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say the top, so the first four are frequent flyers. One I've been on the list pretty much since it was written, I think in the 80s. So the first one is All Boys Aren't Blue, which is a memoir. George M. Johnson, it's a memoir, his coming out story. Mm-hmm. Journey as a young person into college. It's beautifully written. It's very frank. It has a lot of content that I think youth who are struggling with their identity and finding a sense of belonging and thinking, will it get better, that reading this memoir would probably be very comforting to mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. I could also see how some people would not want their children to read that too. Mm-hmm. And so that's a decision that their family gets to make. But I also know that that book could potentially be life-saving for a young person.
Right.
Gender Queer, same thing. Exactly the same thing. The Bluest Eye, third on the list. And then Perks of Being a Wallflower is the fourth.
Wow.
Which,
really?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's kind of with all of them. You're like, really? I mean, but there's fairly consistent themes. There are mostly books that I think are either written for a young adult audience or they might be read by young adults. Mm-hmm. And they do deal with adult themes, mm-hmm. sometimes very frank and difficult conversations, right? Coming through these books that yeah. might not be right for all readers.
Right. I just think it's, when I was a kid, Judy Blume was sort of at the peak of her career. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think about, books like, not necessarily, Tales of a Fourth Grade, Nothing, but like, you know, Then Again, Maybe I Won't, or, you know, mm-hmm. Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret.
Yep.
And this was like 1978. Mm-hmm. I was reading those books. It's astonishing to me that I kind of get the feeling that Judy Blume would have a much harder time today than she did in 19. What was that? That was 37 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting.
She had one actually that was frequently challenged.
Jeannie, I think, yep. is the one. But yeah, okay. So like,
and actually, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret.
Kinda, yeah.
Certainly yeah. has yeah. been. You know, that was that dealt with yep. stuff that people, you know, didn't always want to talk about.
Yeah.
And it was a very important book for me, actually,
oh, sure.
as a kid. But yeah, she,
growing up stuff, it's coming of age stuff, you know. Mm-hmm.
She used to actually talk fairly frankly about the experience of being on that list. She's been on that list herself.
Interesting.
So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there have been some massive cuts made to the government, and right. within that, yeah, I don't know if you've heard about that or not. The government budget's been
they've been reducing some stuff,
gigantic blocks, and how that sort of trickles down to things is like the military academies are having to are being told to mm-hmm. Reduce their libraries and sort of scrub certain things from their histories. And you've got some documentation of that in your hand.
I do. In addition to the top 10 Banna Challenge books from last year, I have actually a list of 381 reading recommendations for folks if they want. These are actually, they're on the Naval Academy Libraries website if you want to look at the full list.
Okay.
I was tempted to try to just do a dramatic reading of the titles on the podcast, but I think it might take me more than an hour. So 381 books.
Wow.
And I haven't actually gone, you know, each individual title, but I have scrolled through this and just at a glance right now, as I'm glancing through pages, I can tell you that every single title on here has to do with race or gender.
Really?
Uh-huh. So it starts with How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi.
That That's the first book.
Is the first one. And that's actually the first way, because I follow him on social media. So it was the first way that I got hip to the list. So
interesting.
And then I went and looked and I thought, oh, wow, there's some really good books on here. So I would say, and Genderqueer is actually number 20 on the list there. Lies My Teacher Told Me, that's a classic. That one's on there. So I would encourage people actually to just Google list of removed books from Nimitz Library if they want to look at the list. Yeah. And take a look and look for yourself at what you think is so. I'm going to say again that this list was produced by the Naval Academy Library.
Interesting.
They put this list out for public consumption. What you don't see is what remained on the shelves. What did they choose to leave behind?
That's, you know, the question I want to ask is, you know, is Mein Kampf still...
two copies.
There it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they still have two copies of that. They also kept the bell curve, which I can tell you is...
Oh!
widely debunked work of bad sociology.
Yeah. Okay, then.
But, you know, with proper context, these books exist in lots of libraries.
Yes. Right.
Well, but that what you're removing here is 381 instances of context. And all in one fell swoop.
I think it's interesting that they published the list. I mean, there's...
Well, I think somebody inside was probably like... Oh,
well,
yeah.
No, and you could... I mean, it's... How do you look at it? Do you look at it as well, here's what we've taken off. This is your tax dollars at work. Your tax dollars will not support this. Mm-hmm. Or is it, well, here's what came out of the library, and just so you know, these are books that are still out there, and you can go get them other places, but not in the Nimitz Library.
I would say the administration's very clear on scrubbing woke ideology, and so that's what this list represents, is what that is regarded.
If I hear that word one more time, I'm gonna, yeah.
Right.
Sort of in that vein, something you brought up when we were getting ready to start recording, the librarian of the Library of Congress, lost her job as we're recording this. Lost her job yesterday. Do you want to, Casey Holden?
Carla Hayden?
Carla Hayden. Okay.
She is. Exemplary doesn't even cover her service through libraries of a very long and impressive career. She actually knew Barack Obama. She was Obama appointee, in 2016. She was appointed as Librarian of Congress, and they were appointed for 10-year terms. These aren't typically political appointments, even though they are made by the executive. But she was the first. She was the first Black Librarian of Congress. She was the first female Librarian of Congress, and I'm about 99% sure she was the first actual librarian, who's a degree librarian, who came up through public libraries. She had a long career in Chicago public libraries, and ending her time there as the executive director, and that's how she got to know Barack Obama, former president. She moved on to Baltimore and really recharged the Baltimore City libraries and brought them back to, and they're beautiful, just wonderful libraries in Baltimore City.
Was that when you were in Richmond?
So it's a remarkable career, and then her appointment as Librarian of Congress was like she became our queen librarian. I like her. I got to meet her at ALA Annual in 2018, and it was quite a moment. One of my favorite pictures, my best friend and Carla Hayden.
That's
and,
pretty
and
cool.
me at the conference. So
she's like the librarian general, right?
Basically.
Yeah.
And she's just a really nice person, too. Yeah. And if Carla, if you're listening to this, I know you're not, like, standing with you. I know that we have definitely not heard the last from her. But to be fired, you know, by email by some random person nobody's heard of, to get an email saying the president's decided it's time for you to go, was absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
A year before the end of her tenure term was pretty appalling.
That's
so,
it's
just
That's
shameful.
It is. But maybe she can now go if she's someone who gets something done, right?
Maybe she's a doer.
Maybe she can go be the executive director of the Obama Presidential Library, and we can actually get that thing rolling,
right? Perhaps. Actually, you know,
in Chicago,
I'm sure she will land just fine. But I think the message that this sends, and the message that the book removal from the Nimitz Library, and then the books that have been banned from the Department of Defense schools,
yes,
school libraries, that the message it's sending, because you said this, like, what does it say? Like, well, you can't get the books here, but you can go off and buy them. But what we're starting to see, too, is that the landscape of publishing has been made much richer and more representative and more interesting by federal funding through the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities,
yeah,
that goes to fund independent presses to publish books uplifting marginalized voices. So that, yeah, fact that she might be able to just go out and buy that book might not actually be as true as it used to be. I have a lot of paper in front of me.
Yeah,
here.
You do.
You can see that. I was looking for the quote from the Coffee House Press, and I don't think I labeled that one, but if I turn it up, I want to share.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there.
You just wouldn't believe it. Well, I think what was my note to you about this is like, I think this is what we'll talk about. Unless something else changes.
Unless something else. And of
and
course,
like,
yeah,
there's lots of material.
And so much changed. I mean, how long do we have?
We've sort of decided this is going to be a regular segment, right, of the show. So, I mean,
yeah. And I have a feeling, we're going to be doing a lot of talking about this as the landscape changed. Because even just since the last time we were on, the ALA's lawsuit about eliminating IMLS was, well, it's a temporary block on the executive order,
mm-hmm,
halting that elimination. But the IMLS funding has also been eliminated from the 2026 proposed budget. And if you just go and fire everybody, if the agency still exists and it's not funded, does it really exist?
Exactly.
You know, if a tree falls in the woods,
exactly,
and
yeah,
no one's around to get hit by the tree. this is the quote from the Coffee House Press executive director that I wanted to share, that she had became alarmed 3 months ago when she received a letter from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is before the grants were just canceled,
mm-hmm,
the other day. So it had a 3-page list of words we could not use in our grant application. Words like woman,
what,
black, gay, all the marginalized people we've been trying to embrace as worthy. Ewing said, I was shocked by that communication, and now this, which means we'll probably have to cut staff or publish fewer books. And that was coming after, this was reported in the Star Tribune, May 6th, after the NEA had abruptly canceled grants. So the chilling effect that this has on publishing,
yep,
this is what this is telling us, and what this is telling me, is that you are not allowed to have these ideas. It's not so much the access to the books. It's the ideas that you're not supposed to hold.
It's that the books will not exist.
Exactly.
It's these words will not be spoken.
Newspeak, right?
Yeah.
Like, if we eliminate the words, the ideas will disappear.
Yeah, but we're probably also going to eliminate 1984, which is the reference there. So,
so let's reference it now while we still can.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah, and another one from about a National Endowment for the Humanities funded projects. This was a letter from Columbia University's Insight Institute, which is a fantastic oral history program through Columbia, and they offer a lot of free educational programming around how to do oral history and how to do it well. Mm. And they got their letter about from the NEH grants that they would be canceled. And also what things that they are not allowed to talk about anymore, which the oral history is, you know, these projects amplify perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I love oral history.
I mean,
it's some of my favorite books to read.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. We got anything else?
We could probably briefly talk about E-rate.
Okay.
Wait, which one do I want to go to next? I'm going to say that I'll tee this up for next time.
Okay,
we'll come back
good.
And do a deeper dive into E-rate and what that means, that as an FCC, just briefly, it's an FCC program that funds a number of technology access programs that have made access to internet possible in rural areas, in poor urban areas. One of the reasons that libraries were early adopters in terms of getting connected to the internet and making that accessible to the public was through E-Rate. So E-Rate funds about 90% of the internet that a lot of libraries provide. We're actually not dependent on it in Northfield, but many of the libraries in our region are. Mm-hmm. So there is right now, the Senate voted to block funding for this program that also funded hotspots that libraries were checking out. So I am hopeful that something changes there, but we can do a deeper dive into the, kind of the background of that and what that's really empowered libraries to do.
Well, I think the thing that I take away from this conversation is something that I think about with a lot of these conversations. If this is something you support, call your elected representatives.
Yes.
If it's something you do not support, call your elected representatives. Mm-hmm. Make your voice heard. That's important in what we call democracy.
It is absolutely the place to end on here. Yeah. So let's keep this democracy running, because if we shut our libraries, there goes our democracy.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So don't let your representatives get any sleep.
Democracy depends on things like this. So, all right. Caitlin, thanks.
Thank you.
And Natalie, of course, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we will be back next month with Library Love.
Library Love. Shh.